0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. The national finals of the community games are on this weekend in County Carlow. They've been going for many decades now, founded by Mr. Connolly, great man, I think about 30 years ago. The community games, just in case you don't know about them, I'll give you a list of competitions: art, gymnastics, handwriting. Isn't that absolutely fantastic? That'd be, if we had one of them on Liveline, that'd be won by Holly Mead, who's with us at the moment, and she has the most stunning handwriting. And well, everyone should improve their handwriting, including my own. Model making, solo dance, solo music, solo recitation, solo singing, swimming, obviously, track, cycle and grass, discus, high jump, javelin, long puck, short puck, and then you go into group music, group singing, camogie, hurling, drafts, chess. Yes, they're all there. It's an incredible. Tag rugby, skittles, rounders. So it's an incredible annual event. But there seems to be maybe a common problem. One, a logistical problem because of so many competitions that you need an early start. But for an early start, you need to be living somewhere or staying somewhere nearby, Carlo. And that seems to be very hard to get. Danny Moore. And Danny, what part of the country are you in?
Hi, Joe, and thanks very much for the opportunity. Good. We're in Baal, County Mayo.
And what's the challenge?
I suppose logistically, and first of all, it's a great opportunity for the girls to have done as well as they've done to get to a semi-finals of a national competition.
Brilliant.
It's exceptional. And as parents, we're just looking for these girls to be able to put their best foot forward and put themselves on the pitch on a level footing. I think 215 kilometres away from a pitch where you're expected to be there at 9 a.m. to play a football match in the national finals is a little bit of a stretch. I don't think anybody could argue against that. I mean, I think I would find it difficult to comprehend how a national finals could be held in Castlebar, 10 minutes away at 9 a.m. in the morning. It would be very unusual. Mm-hmm. I suppose logistically, and I know my partner Suzanne and Johnny Henley are the two coaches, they're exceptional at what they do, and the level of preparation that goes into that is really extraordinary. You're looking at 45 minutes of a warm-up beforehand, which means you're there at 8:15 in the morning.
Okay.
You're really looking at the girls leaving here at 4:30 a.m. in the morning. Then wondering how do they actually get food, where do they stop up or a bite to eat beforehand.
Toilet break, yeah.
And then toilet break, and then tell them in a physical frame of mind and a physical condition to go out and play in a semi-final against a team who are coming further away again in Milford. It just seems a little bit nonsensical, to be honest.
So you're, what, 215k from Carlow. Have you tried to get accommodation next or near Carlow?
Well, I have to say the parents around here have been really innovative. Nobody's going off, you know, giving out about it and saying this is wrong and this shouldn't be happening. We're looking at ways around it. How can you actually, you know, make this plausible and make this, doable for the girls? We have a couple of people who are able to stay with relatives. You're still looking at 40 minutes, an hour away, but the majority of the team, the vast majority, don't have any place to stay close by. Accommodation is booked up or it's very, very expensive. You know, you've girls return to school the following day. It's an expense that parents cannot afford and really shouldn't be asked to fork out for a day before girls returning back to secondary school, which in and of itself is a heavy expense. And I just think that it's a bridge too far to ask girls who are under 16 to have to get up at 4:30 in the morning to travel down to a national final.
Well, if I don't know if Donegal have got to manage to get accommodation. I can't imagine the cost of it. I don't know if Donegal have managed to get accommodation, but if they haven't managed to get accommodation and they're playing you at 9 o'clock in the morning, should they have to leave at 2 o'clock in the morning?
Absolutely, and last year the Ulster team had to pull out of the competition, presumably for similar grounds. So it doesn't add up, and it would be an absolutely crying shame for those girls to have to pull out of a national competition that they've worked so hard to get to. And in the spirit of community games, where you should have that community spirit,
yeah, it's a great
the camaraderie
spirit, yeah.
of the bus journey down there, of the bus journey home. That's what it's all about. You don't want a splinter group where you have five or six girls staying in Cork Leash and Dublin and someplace else, and everybody else then five or six coming down on the bus afterwards. It doesn't make any sense at all.
And have you did you price accommodation next to near Carlow?
We did, and to get accommodation near Carlow is pretty much impossible at this stage. They're all booked out. As a group, that's not doable at all. There's no bookings available that are able to take a group of that size. So everybody is looking individually to see if they could get anything, but it's not feasible, to be honest.
And as you say, individual, if people did get fixed up with their auntie in Port Leash or whatever, it kind of takes the whole... the camaraderie and the fun. There's a lot of fun in it as well, and it's a great. Always has been. The community games are a great atmosphere, but it looks like events and the world that we now live in might have caught up on them. But about the bus, because my daughter, who's a teacher, was organising some events this year. They organised them, but she couldn't believe the increase. Legitimate, by the way, the increase in the cost of hiring a bus compared to last year. Now, have you tried to have a bus sorted?
I work in a school myself, Joe, and I see that firsthand because I've overteamed a school as well. And you're looking at anywhere up to €1,000 for a bus journey down and back, which they have to justify as well. It's somebody working for the day.
It's diesel expensive.
And you're somebody working very unsociable hours to get up at whatever time in the morning to pick up these girls at Manola and bring them down to Carlow. God knows what it would cost from Donegal to come down. That in itself is a huge expense. And it's not only that, the fact that the girls would not be physically capable of going out after being up half the night and then some of them staying down there as well. The ideal scenario would be for everybody to go together, to travel together, to play together in the best possible way that they can, put their best foot forward in a national finals and go out there and do the best they can, represent their community to the best of their ability. 9 a.m. in Carlow on a Sunday morning isn't going to give them that opportunity as far as I'm concerned.
We've had to say, we'll try and get a spokesperson, I'm sure we asked. From the community games, they've always been friends of this programme and it's always been reciprocated because it's a great, great, primarily
and
run
the
by volunteers.
It's fantastic.
They say that the community games say until today we haven't received any official notification indicating this issue with the so we've had no complaints, they say, until today. We're willing to work with any counties in relation to accommodating any teams individuals should the need arise. And it's a bit short notice for you now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very short.
And the timetable was run through every county beforehand. It was issued on July 14th.
Yeah, you just wonder that the whoever is over the timetable, and again, we can't find any person that we can contact and work with on it. That's what everyone wants to do. You want to work with somebody on it and try and come up with an amicable solution to it. But all you get online is an email address. But that's what everyone wants to do. I'm just wondering, whoever was coming up with those timetables, how you configure Donegal and Mayo, 9 a.m. in Carlow, how does that, I don't know how that resonates.
Well, you mentioned Milford, and Sinead Hagan from Milford Parish Community Games is on the line. 0818 715 815, joe@rte.ie is the simple email. Sinead, what's your plans for Saturday? You're playing Mayo at 9 o'clock, aren't you?
Hiya, Joe. We're actually playing Mayo that weekend.
At 9 o'clock.
So we're at 9 o'clock, yeah. So our plan is we're staying down the night before.
Ah, of course.
We're staying. So after our Ulster final, which was against Cavan, after we won that, the Ulsters, we booked our hotel to stay down.
Okay.
But it's like everything else, Joe. It's costing us $2,500 to go down.
Wow.
So for the hotel for 16 girls, and then there's 5 adults going for supervision.
Of course, yeah.
And then the bus down, and of course we have to have the bus driver to stay down with us as well to take us to the pitch. So we're in the middle of trying to fundraise for that at the minute. So $2,500 it is.
And Sinead, and that, is this the first time it's been in Carlow? I thought it was always in Mosny. Now maybe that changed
It's a long time since it was in Mosny. After Mosny, it was in Athlone.
Okay, was that not better?
And then you were able to use the student accommodation in Athlone.
Okay, so that was better.
That was better. And then after Athlone, it was in Limerick, because I was down in Limerick 5 years ago with a team. And again, you were allowed to use the student accommodation there.
Ah, so is there
so
no?
This is the first year that I've been down now to Carlow, and that you have to fend for yourself.
There's no student accommodation in Carlow.
No.
And it's a busy town.
It is a busy town, aye. And like 2,500 it's a lot of money to gather.
Sure. And how are you trying to raise that?
We scratch card things that each of the players have to raise, and we're hoping to do it that way. And we hope that our county will contribute, and our own area will contribute towards.
And Sinead, did you raise the issue of Mayo playing Donegal at 9 o'clock on a Saturday or Sunday, from 9 o'clock in the morning anyway? Did you raise anyone raise the issue? How did those two between
I didn't
you?
Because I knew from experience that it was going to be an early morning game.
Okay.
I've been down before, and it's always because you play two games. The two semi-finals is usually early in the morning, and then the playoffs and the final will be in the afternoon. So from experience, I've always known that's the way it is.
So you're playing two games in one day?
Yeah. You play two games in the one day.
Sure, you'd be wrecked.
I know.
No, your brilliant group will be wrecked, even though they're staying in the area the previous night. But
yeah.
I'm thinking of Danny. Danny, your crew will be up. If they're getting a bus at 4 o'clock, they're up at 2 o'clock. They're up at 2 o'clock, they won't go to bed.
No.
And then it's
a nightmare. Both
and then
school
the following morning as well. Yeah.
Yeah, school the following morning then as well. Yeah.
James, good afternoon.
How you doing? How are you?
You're listening to the scheduling.
I am, yeah.
What do you think?
Who's scheduling the matches for 9 o'clock in the morning?
I presume it's in the organiser, is it, Danny? I presume.
We don't know. As I said, we can't get a contact. It's just an email address if you look online, so we can't actually get a contact of who has scheduled them. And again, this isn't to pick somebody out and to place blame and say, you know, you're wrong.
No,
it's to work with people and say, you know, let's try and make it a bit more accessible
But given that you might be playing...
The girls have to get up at 4:30 in the morning to make a match for 9 o'clock.
I mean,
if their match was scheduled for noon, what time would they have to get up at? 8, maybe?
Is there not a backup at the other end, James, in that if they get through, they'd be either playing a playoff or in a final?
Yeah.
So
it's quite possible, I'm sure. But, I mean, it doesn't seem very fair to be getting people up in the middle of the night, really, and then expecting them to play a match at 9 o'clock in the morning.
And James, the bus is at 4:30. They'll be up at 2:30. And if you, I don't know whether you have teenagers.
You get to go to bed.
I don't know if you have teenagers. But you try and tell a teenager you have to get up at 2:30, they won't go to bed.
I was saying I have that issue as well, as far as them staying in a hotel. I mean, sure, what time are they going to go to sleep for us either? You know, and we have to be up early in the morning as well. I know the accommodation was very tight or very hard to get. Our provincials was on the 15th of July, so we booked right away.
You knew immediately, okay.
Aye.
I'm not aware of the you were mentioning, Joe, the backside of it, that there might be scheduling issues on the backside of it. I'm not aware of all that, but it does seem kind of ludicrous that getting people up at 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning to go to play a match at 9 in the morning. It just seems a bit ridiculous.
Hopefully now that they're well, hopefully we'll be dealt with. But I say we have a statement from the Community Games, which I've read out the gist of it there. They say they weren't aware of any problem, but they are now, I presume. So, and it is. I know there's a lot of sports and hurling and football and etc. and cycling and swimming. But then when you look at areas like model making, I love it, chess, choir, culture corner, drafts, group dance, handwriting, quiz. It's just magnificent. It's magnificent. Anyway, we will see what if we get any further reaction. Danny, safe travelling above all else. Sinead
Good
Hagen.
Luck, Danny.
Do I say up Mayo or up Donegal? No, I won't get involved.
It's all right, Daddy. I'll see you down there.
Okay. And James, go to meet him. I'll get Joe at rt.ie 51551 text. Aisling, where are you? Aisling Burns.
Hi, Joe. How are you? I'm in the Greek island at the moment, Harry King.
And what's the name of the island?
It's just one of the Greek islands.
Well, okay, you don't want to say where at this stage. Okay, how are things with you? Why did you contact us? What's wrong?
So, we booked an apartment to... We arrived up by ferry into the island on Tuesday. Yeah. And we booked it through booking.com for 1 week for €1,800.
Okay.
So we arrived off the ferry at 12 o'clock in the day, met a young girl to give us the keys. And pretty much from the second we walked into the apartment, we realised it was hugely unsafe. We're travelling with a one-year-old and a seven-year-old.
Okay.
And so we walked to the front steps. The front railing was basically coming away. Got into the main apartment. The balcony, the railings of the balcony had fully fallen off.
Gone.
Gone. And rotted. So on the right side, fully gone. And then rotted out the whole way through the thing. So if anybody leaned against us, the whole lot of it would have completely come away.
Good God.
So we obviously contacted the owner within, I'd say, 15, 20 minutes of us being there. Made him aware of the issues, and he was like, what's your problem kind of thing. So we contacted booking.com, obviously, as we'd booked it through them.
Mm-hmm.
Explained the situation, and they said to us, look, we understand your problem.
Mm-hmm.
We'll send you alternative accommodation. But you have to give the guy 24 hours. You have to give the owner 24 hours with which to rectify the situation. So they're like, yeah, look, that's fine. The owner contacts us and he says, we'll have a carpenter there at 10 a.m. tomorrow. So okay, look, that's fine. At least you're trying to rectify it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to move. It's a lot of hassle. So 10 a.m. rolls around the next morning and I actually texted him. He texted us to say the carpenter was running late. And then I texted him saying the washing machine didn't work. The front window was, the lock on it was broken, so you could just push the window open into the bedroom where our children were sleeping. The AC didn't work. Just a long list of issues. So, obviously, pack our stuff, we leave, contact our booking.com again,
mm-hmm.
and they say, no, we're not giving you anything. We're not giving you any refund.
So, where are you now, Aisling?
We are currently, so, the problem is there's a big religious festival on the 15th of August. We've had to move hotels, either hotels or hotel rooms, every day since Tuesday. So packing up a one-year-old and a seven-year-old, move rooms, move hotels, and basically just try to find accommodation. So we did try to leave. We did try to just get back home, but that wasn't an option. We couldn't change our flights. The flights out of Athens are only Friday, and it just didn't work logistically to be able to get the ferry on time to get back to Athens. So we were just stuck here. So literally every single day we get up,
okay,
we trawl through the streets try to find somewhere to stay.
And what's the temperatures out there?
It's 32 degrees right now.
And you're traipsing around with did you say you had a two-year-old?
A one-year-old, a seven-year-old. I'm heavily pregnant myself. And 40 kilos of luggage. So, like, the first hotel we stayed in, the lady was absolutely phenomenal. She rang around. She got us the odd room here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And then yesterday she was like, look, there's nothing else I can do for you. So we just had to literally walk the streets and try to find somewhere to stay. Now, fortunately, we found the room we're in now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's fine. But we've had to pay for all of this out of pocket.
Course,
we spent our whole holiday contacting booking.com. So on yesterday, I finally got... So they've listed our cancellation as unmet expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to them very, very clearly, I was like, the place is unsafe. We've been threatened by the owner. What is the situation here? You think that I should stay within this property? And they were like, well, it's your decision to leave. And I said, but it's unsafe. Like, I can't leave my children here.
Mm-hmm.
There's electrical wires hanging out of the floor or out of the walls with the one-year-old. But subsequently, so we looked it up, the apartment that we're in, we looked it up on Airbnb because we're like, this has to be.
Okay.
See, but, there has to be more to this.
And what do
they
say?
Airbnb states very, very clearly not suitable for children.
Well, what else? What attracted you to it on booking.com?
It looked like a lovely apartment. Like, if it had looked anything like this photograph, it wouldn't be fine. It looks nothing like the photographs. It was filthy dirty. Now, to be fair, he did send a cleaner around the next day to clean the place. But,
yeah,
like,
but that's a day gone off your precious holiday, for God's sake.
Exactly, exactly. And it's been just like this back and forth with booking.com. Like, so on the Wednesday, I said to him, can you email me what our options are? Yes, we'll send you an email. Never did. On Thursday, I rang them. I spoke to them. I said, look, can you call me back and clarify? Because I wanted to know, what can I do here? Never called me back. And then yesterday, I was talking to one agent. He said to me, we should have been referred to the safety team. If you say you're unsafe, you're being threatened with the police, you should have been referred to the safety team.
Well, you
so
sent,
I don't understand.
Did you not send us... I was looking at them earlier, so you... did you not send us images earlier on of the railings?
Yeah. And I've sent them to booking.com. They said there's nothing wrong with the place.
So the railings look like they're made of jelly. They're wobbling. They're about to...
And to go up with a young child in a buggy, heavily pregnant, to lean against those, it's just an absolute death trap.
When are you due back?
Friday. But like, it's just been the
and
last.
And how come?
Week
by the way, how come he's on? How come they're on Booking.com and Airbnb?
Oh, so that was the other point. So we left on the Wednesday. He re-advertised the place, so he is now double rented the place. So he's making double rent. It's on. It was on Airbnb on the Thursday, and then it was fully booked. So we went and looked at the apartment because we're just beside it, and there's people in there. So he's made double the money, and Booking.com see no issue with this whatsoever. The guy highlighted to them, I know they're probably the owner hasn't been paid out yet, so you're allowing him to make $3,600 for a unit for 1 week. And none of the issues have been repaired.
And by the way, the island, I don't know why you won't tell me the island you're on, but I'm sure you have your reasons. But, like, the island you're on, is it a modern island? Like, how does your accommodation compare and contrast?
Oh, like, the next place we stayed in was absolutely fabulous. There was a hot tub on the balcony. Okay. It was beautiful. Like, it's not...
But you only could... You could only... They could only fit you in for a few days.
For one night.
Ah, for God's sake.
Yeah. So, like, we're very... We take both of our Asians travel. So, we are not... Yeah. Delicate by any stretch.
Okay.
The child's going to be changed.
Okay, your line is gone on me completely, Aisling. Aisling, safe... I was going to say safe travelling, but look after yourself. There's children and you're pregnant and there's like the Holy Family there looking for somewhere to stay. So, Aisling, we'll keep...
On Friday night, we ended up... On Friday night, the only reason how we got accommodation was I was sitting in a cafe roaring, crying. The local lady came up to us and was like, what's wrong? And I was like, we need somewhere to stay tonight. And she found us a place. And this, I've communicated all this to Booking.com. You do not care. Like, you use Booking.com as a safety mechanism so that you have some comeback. And they've just ignored it. They've just absolutely
We've been on to them, and we normally find them very helpful. So we wait and see. Aisling, look after yourself. Where are you going to stay? Have you somewhere to stay for the next 4 days?
We've somewhere to stay tonight, and then we go to Athens tomorrow. We've been
on Facebook and that. And that's okay. Mind yourselves, would you please?
Thank you.
Yeah, but Aisling, it's slashing here. It's lashing. It's lashing.
It's very hot here. It's
biblical. Okay. I don't know who's... Anyways, above all, safe travel. Thanks for contacting us. Mind yourself, Aisling. That's Aisling Burns. Annie, good afternoon. Off that harrowing phone calls we had on Friday of women, beginning with an incredible woman and loads of incredible women in between, and finishing with another incredible woman, Sarah, beginning with Lindsay. And that is the whole issue of breast reduction. Women who, for whatever reason, and many, as we heard, a number of people saying it, their breast size had changed dramatically during the menopause. But anyway, they need breast reduction. And the VHI, and it seems other companies, other health providers are saying that to qualify for breast reduction, which, as we heard on Friday, is a life-changing operation, relatively simple insofar as, but life-changing operation for people who've gone through it. But to qualify for this breast reduction surgery, if you have VHI, you need to be down to a particular weight, your BMI. And this is proving extraordinarily difficult for people who are in this dilemma. Annie, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good. What's your situation, Annie?
So I have an appointment with a consultant next month.
Okay.
Again, I have VHI. My BMI is above what it needs to be. but very difficult to get it down. I also have a congenital hypothyroid, which means losing weight is difficult anyway.
Okay.
I eat well, I exercise, but like the ladies who were discussing on the menopause on how things slow down and how hard it is to shift weight, it just gets harder and harder with my condition as it stands. So that's going against me. And then also, I think one of your callers last week discussed about, like, even going out for a walk. Like, I've never gone out with less than 3 sports bras for a walk, a run. Okay. Well, I can't run. I won't run now because, obviously, I don't want people to see me running. And second of all, I know I have an issue on my right-hand side with my neck.
Which a lot of women in your situation talked about on Friday as well.
Yeah, like I'd have numbness in my hands. But I know when I go for this appointment, I won't. They'll just, the VHI will say no. So my option is to put myself into an awful lot of debt to have this done. Or I'm not going to say starve myself, but, you know, cut down what I'm eating drastically in an unhealthy way. And that's not right either.
You have neck pain. We heard of excruciating neck pain on Friday, excruciating back pain. And then the neck pain, which is due to the size of your breasts in relation to the size of your body, the neck pain is generating loss of sensation in your fingers.
Yeah. So I have I've had an MRI and there's a bone spur there, and they feel like the bone spur has happened because of the size of my breasts. Now, I was referred publicly, but the waiting list was 5 years long, and I came into a situation where I now have VHI cover, and I thought, oh, this is great, not realising, gosh, it's just not going to happen. I mean, it's just not going to happen. I know it's not. So it is difficult. It is hard.
Well, it seems to be a catch-22.
It is. It's 100% a catch-22.
Just to remind listeners, and you're saying it as well, Annie, this is not a cosmetic procedure.
No.
This is a life-changing, positive life-changing procedure.
Yeah. And it would help me to live a healthier life. Not a healthier life, but, you know, it opens more doors to be able to do more things if I don't have this issue. It's not about going into town and buying a dress that I want to buy, or it's not about being able to go in and buy a cheaper bra. It's about being comfortable and feeling comfortable. And not only from a mental health point of view, but also a physical point of view. But it's just the discomfort is so much, but you just have to get on with it. You know, it's not going to change unless the VHI help us out, but I don't know if they will.
But even econometrically, working out for the VHI to try and deal with this, because this is the big example for me on Friday was the fact that women contacted us who had this breast reduction. Now, a number of them managed to save the money themselves, but they said it was so life-changing.
Yeah,
they were
their
life completely opens.
A best friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, had surgery abroad 2 years ago, and she would say that it was life-changing. Absolutely. It has changed her life completely.
And my point is, well, then that means a reduction in hospitals, visits, doctors, medics, consultants in perpetuity. Do this operation now, and it will save a lot of money in the future.
Absolutely.
And then the other, it's so... What was the other issue that came up on Friday, Annie? Was one of the women was saying, in the society we live in and the portrayal of women in movies, big breasts are regarded as something very attractive at times.
And I would go so far as to say I feel mine make me look vulgar. Does that make sense? Like that you are more than what's attached to your body. Like, I've been in work situations where male members of staff have looked, not in my current work situation, but where male members of staff have not looked me in the eye.
Yeah.
And I will be very modest about it. It's always about covering it. Always about covering it up. Always. You know.
So, we're all told, try and like your body and like yourself.
Yeah.
Well, from what you're saying, you've...
we live in a society now where we're told body positivity, be positive to your body, you know, speak to yourself like you'd speak to a small child, say one positive thing about yourself in the mirror every day. That is so hard when you're living in this catch-22, when you can't fix what's wrong, no matter how hard you try, you can't fix it, and there's no help.
Yeah, you also say you have a big milestone ahead of you.
Yeah, I'm getting married next month, so. Well,
congratulations.
Thanks.
Congratulations, yeah.
But it did, it was hard, you know, choosing a dress and...
Yeah.
And I didn't want to get emotional.
Yeah, no, don't be... because Friday's program, for a lot of people, I suspect a lot of men, brought them into an area that they maybe didn't think about. Well, obviously, the powers that be don't think about it. If there's a 5-year waiting list on the public for a relatively simple operation, but a magnificently life-changing, positive operation, if there's a 5-year waiting list. And then VHI, VHI, by the way, did say to us on Friday, and I'll say it again, they have an appeal system. And then for people who are very distressed, as Sarah was at the end of the programme on Friday, Dr. Mary Ryan happened to be on at the same time. And I know Mary and Sarah are in email contact now. And as you heard, if you were listening, that Mary wants Sarah to go to her GP immediately. Sarah felt extraordinarily alone. Extraordinarily alone, because you then get into that whole situation. I don't want to go out of the house. I don't want people to see me. Then you get then you're stuck in the house. Then you get more fed up, and it's almost as if the illness is telling you, or the difference is telling you, you can't do anything about me. You can't do anything about me, and you just go. You go deeper and deeper into that corner.
Yeah,
that is the danger. It hasn't happened in your case. Well, we heard it from Sarah.
No.
And the fact, as I said on Friday, the fact that Sarah could ring was a magnificent step on her part, a most courageous step. Annie, thanks for highlighting it.
Thanks for having me. And I just want to say, Dr. Ryan, you couldn't have a better person in your corner. She is amazing.
Oh, great.
She's an amazing woman.
Okay. Thanks a million, Annie. And by the way, best of luck. Have a great day and good health to you and your partner in the life ahead. Thanks indeed, Annie. Joe at RT.ie. Where's Mary? Mary, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you, Joe? How are you doing?
What's your situation?
More or less same situation. The BMI is the issue. I have had VHI for a long number of years. Have had different procedures done through them, but again, the BMI for the breast reduction that's considered cosmetic. Even the consultant I'm seeing at the moment has said that they have different meetings with VHI, saying basically that it's not a cosmetic surgery because it changes life so much. It would bring us back in. I've been on painkillers for years now at this stage. I'm in my mid-40s. Killed myself losing weight, lost 10 pounds, still over the BMI threshold. We'll have to go for another maybe 8 months to lose another 10 pounds to get it down to the ridiculous what they say is required. So I think it is a constant problem.
Because Mary, you're raising... and I didn't raise it there with Annie, but it came up with everyone on Friday. They're all on medication, painkillers, stronger painkillers, injections.
Yeah, I did the same. I had cortisone injected into my shoulders for pain.
If any health organisation had an opportunity to try and end that, and it was as straightforward as breast reduction, which apparently it is. Well, then surely they jump at that opportunity to get people.
Well, you would think so, because in the long term it'll benefit. Because, and I had this conversation with the consultant quite openly, I won't go to a gym setting at the moment.
I go to an
all women gym, say, which is a circuit I do, but I would not walk into my local hotel into that gym the way I am now, because I'd be so paranoid about it. I have to wear 2 bras if I go for a run.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, I'm doing all the right things, but it's not getting me anywhere to help me reduce that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So, and like your other listeners, I am very much a cover up. I do not expose myself in any way or shape or form, but that even in yourself to be able to wear a shirt that doesn't gape, you know, just to feel better about yourself, I suppose, you know, is the big thing. No, I don't know that it will change anytime quick, to be honest, Joe.
Well, looking at, I'm very surprised by the number of women who are in the same situation, Mary.
Yeah, shocking, really, actually. And again, a 5-year wait list on the public.
Shocking.
So, you know, they're encouraging people to get VHI or whatever insurance it is, health insurance.
Yeah.
And then they come up with these kind of, you know, non-realistic goals that have to be achieved, you know.
Okay, Mary, thanks indeed, and
best
wishes. Thanks for raising that. Joe at rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We were talking last week, it's been going on for nearly 10 days now. Talking began with the Deepest Breath, that incredible documentary that's on Netflix. And then people start talking about adventuring. And then we spoke to Mike O'Shea, who organised a lot of the stunts in Mission Impossible and has done the South Pole and has retraced the steps of Tom Green and has climbed K2. And he just spoke about what is it in people that pushes them to achieve. Now, at the weekend, you would have seen that there was a massive controversy on K2 in that a climber that became unwell was passed by a significant number. They stepped over him to try and get to the top of K2, and they ignored him. Now, a Norwegian mountaineer subsequently came forward and says her team, she tried to save he was a porter, but the porter died on K2. And she's rejecting allegations based on drone footage of climbers walking over the man during the record ascent. But it was the record ascent. But there's a whole thing about, would you, and I asked Mike O'Shea this, would you turn back if you felt you were in danger, given it's such an incredible achievement? And he told us he's turned back twice from the North Pole. He still hasn't managed that. Now, Tony Burke. Tony, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
You've tried Everest.
I was back in 1993 on the first successful Irish Everest expedition. Yeah.
Okay. And how did you get on?
Oh, yeah, fantastic from my perspective. We successfully got the first successful Irish ascent with Dawson Stelfox.
Of course, yeah.
And I was in the climbing team. And the key point is the team. And myself and Robbie Fenlon got to 8,500 metres, just 300 metres short. And we had to take a decision, as you were just mentioning there. We had to take a decision in terms of the weather starting to turn not so great, running out of oxygen. And we took the view that the expedition was a success. As a team, we got the first Irish Everest expedition completed successfully, with Dawson getting to the top. And we could have easily have turned success into tragedy, because at over 8,500 metres is a very difficult place to be, and the likelihood of getting killed when the weather turns bad is pretty high. So I think we've ultimately made... But you know what? I was delighted to be on the edge of space up on the North Ridge of Everest. And to me, that was a success for me. That's how I saw it.
But this particular story is that a porter and a guide died after falling off an edge, but that these climbers is accused of stepping over the injured climber to keep going for their endeavour. Can you imagine? Yeah, can you imagine that happening?
Yeah. It's a difficult one, because I've actually sort of followed up on some of various articles and blogs, etc., in respect of this. And I think fundamentally, if you look at the surface of what you're saying there, from my perspective, it's not right. But at the same time, the where they were on the mountain is a very difficult, narrow location on K2. And it is also, from what I've read, and the feedback I've had is that they were trying to help him, and unfortunately he didn't make it, which is really sad. But and I think there's been a lot of attention given to the Norwegian climber in terms of forging ahead. And my understanding was that she spent an hour and a half trying to help and attend, and there was somebody trying to look after him. And she, my understanding is she had a problem further up the mountain with the forward team on K2, and she had to sort of get away from that narrow spot, which was already overcrowded, and move up to where there were problems occurring further up the mountain.
But she said, this Norwegian climber, Christian Harilas, she said that the footage showing climbers stepping over Hassan on K2 was shot after hours of work had gone into trying to save him. In other words, he was deceased. None of those efforts, you said, were caught on camera. It was a very tragic accident. We feel sorry for Hassan and his family, obviously. While she said she was not with Hassan when the footage was shot, we were just behind him when he fell. We saw him hanging upside down, and very early we decided we needed to try to get him turned around. She described how two members of the expedition made their way to where Hassan was hanging, the second succeeding in bringing him back to the trail. And after about half an hour with Hassan, Harilas, she said the team decided to split up because they had heard on the radio that members of a rope-fixing team up ahead were possibly in danger themselves. But why didn't they turn back?
Yeah, it's a broader, this is a broader point on this one, really, because when you look at the, like Everest, for example, in K2, and the, you know, the number of bodies at Everest, for example, exceeds about 200. There's, well, nearly 400 people have climbed K2, and I think there's been about 90 deaths on K2.
But why
and
don't...
It sort of raises, it raises that broader perspective of humanity in terms of, you know, is the success of topping out when people are dying around you really worth it? And I think it's a for me personally, if I was in that position, but I've actually been in a position in the Alps where I've seen two people get killed, and we had to rescue the third member of that party in the Alps. So I've experienced, you know, seeing people falling off a mountain and having to rescue a third person off the mountain. So for me, the objective of gaining the achievement becomes secondary. So from my own personal experience, having been through it in the Alps, it's the primary focus is really how can you help the person get off the mountain? How can you help, you know, is the humanity, which I think is sometimes forgotten. That's just my own personal view. But the difficulty is
and I know you said you were in you were on the Alps and you saw tragically two people being killed and you helped rescue the third person. If you're in an event, but there's a small group and one of your group dies, surely nobody would want to continue.
Yeah, many of the events in the non-mountaineering area, and some of the mountaineering ones will stop. Like the long-distance ultra-running events, if the problem occurs, it very often they will stop the event. But in my view, there's too many people, possibly inexperienced. The view of risk on the mountains has shifted because it's become more sanitized, more commercial, more support systems put in place, which gives the view of risk being at a lower threshold. K2 is a particularly difficult mountain. It's more difficult than Everest, technically. We've had some good successes, you know, within from Irish climbers also. But the thing is, for me, and this is my own personal view, is that the goal of getting to the top has got to be secondary to actually trying to help somebody. And people try to rationalize it in different ways. They say, well, it was too narrow. We couldn't spend the time there. There was too many people in the danger zone. If we try and rescue people, it puts more people at risk. But then you start to think, well, you need to step back and think, in terms of the mountains are really beautiful. Mountains are really challenging. And the adventure is fantastic. But really, is it worth the number of lives that have been lost in some of these...
And have you ever found yourself in dangerous situations?
Oh, many times. I've used up my... They say a cat has nine lives, and I've probably used up I think pretty much all nine lives. And I think you need to get reserved one every so often. But I take a much more relaxed Nordic walk these days. I do Nordic walking instruction, which has moved away a little bit from the mountains. But I've put myself right on the edge in the past, and it was driven by adventure, driven by, and to be honest with you, sometimes driven by ego, quite frankly. When you're younger, some of those forces of ego seem to dominate.
Okay. And you say now, what do you concentrate, Norwegian walking?
No, it's basically, it's Nordic walking. Yeah,
Nordic walking, sorry, okay.
Yeah, we set up Nordic Fitness Ireland, so we're teaching instructors all over the country now, which is, we take them into the mountains sometimes, but it's much more leisurely than actually climbing ice falls and climbing rocks. But I still love the mountains. They're a beautiful place to be. And it's the risk level is obviously a lot lower than in the mountains. But when you've been on the edge for many years, sometimes it's good not to try and search out to use up more of your nine lives.
Okay, well, safe travelling, Tony. It was another tragedy, unfortunately. That's Tony Bourke, and congratulations on your achievement and over the years. Why do people do it, Tony? Why? Now, why not, says you, and because it's there. I know all those lines, but what is it?
It's the sense of adventure. It's the challenge. Yeah. It's the beauty. It's the physical push. It's the camaraderie you have with the people that you're climbing with. It's all of that. Most spectacular parts of the planet, and you're on the top of the most beautiful mountains, and that is fantastic. But they're not so beautiful when there's lots of people dying around you. That is not the place to be in my personal view. That is
okay. Tony, safe travelling. That's Tony Bourke. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Ray Dunn. Ray, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
You've been on with us before. Now, you've a very difficult argument to make here, or to prove. Do you want to put forward your thesis? First of all, it's about the lotto. Secondly, it's about the Euro Millions draw, which was heavily advertised on this station, other platforms last week, because there was an extra draw, an extra prize, specifically for anyone who bought a Euro Millions ticket in Ireland. And that extra prize was 1 million euro, which I presume was successfully won at the weekend. Now, what is the glitch that you've seen, Ray, and you want to argue?
Well, yeah, again, Joe, it's a perceived glitch in my mind. Mm-hmm. But the way the lotto will work is that every ticket will have an individual number.
Okay.
And every draw that takes place for the Euro Millions, if you have a ticket in that, there's a special draw where they'll pick out 10 numbers, like a raffle, of the individual tickets. Mm. And those people, will, no matter what happens to the draws of the numbers, you get 5,000 euro.
Okay.
And that's grand. That's a standalone little draw. And that's great. But my problem is these extra draws they run with the 1 million euro extra prize. It says it's open to all. Mm-hmm. This is where the interpretation comes in.
Okay.
But in fact, I believe it's not, because the only people who are entered into this 1 million euro draw are the 10 people who have already been picked out and have received a €5,000 draw.
So let me come at it backwards for a second. So you're saying they were advertising last week saying, and remember, this week, if you buy a Euro Millions ticket and your numbers come up, well, then you win the Euro Millions. But for people specific, because Euro Millions is all across Europe, but people specifically in Ireland were throwing in an extra 1 million.
Has to be one in Ireland, yeah.
It has to be one in Ireland, of course. But in fact, what they gave out was 1 million and 5,000 euro, because whoever won that 1 million to get into the last 10 had to win 5K. Am I correct?
Place. Yeah.
So it was a two-tier draw.
Yes, you could say that it's a two-tier. But how do you get to the second tier? Is what I would have a problem with. in that by being picked in the first 10, you've actually now got a Willy Wonka golden ticket.
Yeah.
That only you and the other 10 are now going to participate in the €1 million draw. Now, this is despite the fact that they say it's open to everybody. Now, you would need to speak to someone special about permutations and computations and odds to work out. But in reality, I think what should happen is those 10 tickets, when they receive their €5,000, they should go back into the drum.
Okay.
They rattle the drum, and then they pull out one ticket and they say, this is the winner of the €1 million. Because that's actually how it's advertised, that it's an extra draw above and beyond what we normally do. Now, again, that's my interpretation, and I'm sure you might have one, and others might have one.
Okay, 51551 is the text number. What they're saying, you see, I heard the ads. I heard them when I listened to ads, anyway, and I love ads. But it did say, this is the angle I would come at it from. It did say, you have a chance, if you're in Ireland, you buy your ticket in Ireland, you have a chance of winning an extra million, only in Ireland, only open to Irish contestants. In Ireland. But in fact, what they don't tell you is you're not going to win a million. You're going to win €1,005,000, and 9 other people are going to win 5k as well,
and the rest will get nothing apart from what they win in the normal draws
if they're lucky enough. So you're saying what they should have done was, if they're insisting on picking out the 10 Willy Wonka people, and then they put their name into a smaller hat, obviously. And then someone who's already lucky enough to win 5, which is a significant amount, has then a 10 to 1 chance of winning a million. Whereas you think that, I don't know many people,
everyone should have an equal chance. Pick a number. Everyone should have an equal chance. Because this is an extra draw above and beyond what normally happens.
Where's Bernard Dorkin when I need him? Where's
tell me, tell what you think. I think it's crazy.
No,
you
see, it's not what I feel.
Somewhat cheated, you know.
Well, they're not. You see, and we asked a lot of them, come on, and they're a massive organisation in Ireland, and they're massive, massively supported by the Irish people. Massively.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
And especially people in working class areas support them, as we know from all the studies. But they continually refuse to provide a spokesperson to explain this to us.
Well, I did contact them since last year or the year before, Joe, on exactly the same subject, and just wouldn't talk to me, you know.
Well, not since the day that Ray Bates... Remember Ray Bates?
He
was the face of... He's the one that got the lotto going in Ireland almost single-handedly and made it such a warm, comfortable trusting. I'm sure it is still trusted. I don't know who owns the lotto now. It keeps changing hands.
The only thing
I know is we don't own it.
The Canadian Teachers Fund for a while, and I think a Spanish company owns it now.
We cashed in on it originally. We sold it originally, I think, 2016 to pay for the children's hospital, and that was the argument then. But it's now they do say,
€4 million, is it?
Yeah, but remember, the lotto has a monopoly license from the state. It has a license from the state to run this lotto. No one else can run a lotto like it in this state. And that's the reason is they give money to good causes. And that's why it's so heavily promoted. Now, I have a statement from the lotto here somewhere, which again is... I just don't want to become... I didn't join RTE to become a newsreader. You know, I'm just not going to sit here reading out these statements when these are massive organisations with people that are well able to talk, and they're well able to talk when they're launching a new game and trying to get advertising for it.
Exactly, yeah.
But anyway, I'll do it because I have to do it. A lotto statement. Just to clarify an important point regarding Friday's special Euro Millions draw, which guaranteed an additional top-up prize of €1 million in Ireland. Okay, well, maybe. Each and every ticket purchased throughout the country for Friday night's Euro Millions draw had an equal chance of winning the special €1 million raffle prize.
Now, in my view.
Well, dispute that line then.
Well, because the only people who were allowed into at the final draw were to those 10 golden ticket winners. And I'm sure they're quite happy they were in the draw. And if I was one of them, I would be very happy. But again, it's permutations of going, the permutations of winning the 10 golden tickets in the first place. And then having the added bonus of
your point is yeah. I'm looking for somebody who records RTE programmes who might have recorded that ad for us last week, and we could listen back to the app. But what they say is, as with every Euro Millions draw, the Ireland only raffle sees 10 winners drawn at random, and they each win €5,000, and then one of these 10 winners then has an additional €1 million added to their prize. But that's not, is it your point? That's not what is advertised.
But that's the way I see it. Now, that's my interpretation of it. That it's, the €1 million is open to everybody.
But what they say is...
You might say it is, and that the 10 tickets were in there in the first place and they were drawn to take part
in
two
draws. Prize, but almost semantic point is that they say we guaranteed an additional top-up prize of €1 million. It wasn't a top-up prize of €1 million in the end. It was a top-up prize of €1,005,000 because you had to win the €5,000 to get through the gate and leave the hundreds of thousands of the high polloi outside. And there was 10 of you now in the field. And the 10 of you in the field who all have €5,000 in your maw. You now, I presume they put your names in a hat, and out comes your names, and one of you has €5,000 and €1 million in your hand now.
That's it. It was one in Limerick, Joe, by the way.
Congratulations.
Lucky Limerick. Yeah.
But they're saying because they do with every Euro Millions draw, did you know they did it with every you did, obviously?
No, the €1 million is specific, maybe once or twice a year, and I think they run that.
The Ireland only raffle, okay.
It's unclaimed prize money.
Depending on the amount of
unclaimed prizes, then it could be one, two, or three a year, or none, depending on.
I thought the whole thing about the unclaimed, that used to be where the unclaimed prizes went back into prizes.
I thought
the new franchise holder got a change where the unclaimed prizes could go into marketing.
I can't argue with you, Joe.
We need to hear that ad, Ray. Okay, I don't know about the stats and the permutations, I did not know from listening avidly to all the ads that I just thought they put everyone's ticket in and the computer picks a combination of numbers around the back and not the numbers you've used in for your lottery.
Yeah, one-off numbers. Yeah.
The unique number that every ticket has, regardless of the number of lines you buy. Okay, yeah. Ray, do you think you're going to get anywhere?
No, I'm depending on you, Joe. You're the man with the contacts, Joe.
No contacts. Can't even persuade him to come on the programme.
Oh, there you go. Just as an added thing, Joe, the community games we're talking about, Joe.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Where I live, that was and is a great thing. And my wife was active in that for many years in the Mead branch. And absolutely fabulous, the whole thing.
Yeah,
whole
it is great.
Setup,
it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, Coramina and Mahagat. And Ray, do you buy tickets for the lotto?
Unfortunately, I do, yeah. I'm one of the suckers. I pay the fool's tax regularly, as it's called, you know.
Okay.
And my wife reminds me constantly what an idiot I am, but, you know. I could have bought 10 houses over probably what I've spent over the years, you know, like most people. You don't see it adding up a couple of euros here and there every week, you know.
Yeah. Okay, Ray, another conundrum which we can't solve. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie. Anya, good afternoon. Your point, please, is you're again back to this difficult position that a lot of women find themselves in. Go ahead, Anya.
Hi, Joe. Yeah. I had to message in when I heard Annie speaking because it's something that's been a big issue for me as well. I'm only 36. My breasts have always been big, even since I was like a young teen. I have VHI, and I'm lucky to have that, but I don't fall within the BMI range. But even separate from VHI, my GP has tried to get me an appointment with a private consultant just to see, like, down the line if I could ever save up to afford it. And she wouldn't even see me because I was outside the BMI range that she had. So she had her own BMI limit. So I'm 36 now. I can't get bras in my size in Ireland because that's how big they are. And just to think about going into my 40s, 50s, and beyond, like, I'm carrying 7 kilos on my chest alone, and it's just extraordinary. Like, I have a bit of a hump in my back, I get recurrent injuries in my muscles, and I'm just in pain all the time, and it's just so difficult to deal with. Like, I have a history of disordered eating, so even ethically I can't be recommended to go on a severely restricted diet, which isn't good for your health anyway.
Now, we've heard this before, that this was the dilemma raised on Friday by a number of women, that private, if you go privately to a consultant, the BMI bar can change. It's the VHI and the other health providers that have this very strict BMI bar.
Well, even like from what I know of my VHI policy, the BMI limit on that is 25. And the BMI limit for the private consultant that I was referred to is 27. So it's still not inclusive for people who need access to that surgery. And as you were saying in your discussion with Annie, it's not cosmetic. It's literally just for your health. The enormous pressure that it puts on your back, on your posture, on my ability to move. Like, I know somebody was saying before about wearing 2 bras and they go running. Like, I can't run. And it's just really painful. And I just don't know how to go into an older age while keeping this weight on my chest. It's just a consideration all the time. And like, and if you any, saying, it's not even about clothes.
On your view, an idea of what the difference in, I'm sure we can find out quickly, what the difference in weight would be between a BMI of 25 and a BMI of 27?
I don't. I just know that is just not, it's not attainable for me.
Okay, as it wasn't. It was our first caller on Friday, who started this avalanche, she was 5 pounds out. We've been contacted by Mr. Jamie Martin Smith, who's a consultant, a plastic surgeon in Dublin, in Beaumont, among other places. Jamie, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. Good afternoon. I just caught the second half of the story, so I thought I'd bring in.
What is the difference, do you know? I'm not saying between, off the top of your head, between a BMI of 25 and a BMI of 27 weight wise, do you know, Jamie?
So it's a ratio. It depends on the height.
Okay.
So there isn't an absolute cutoff. Otherwise, it would just be a weight restriction, but it's not. I mean, the BMI is just a fairly broad, encompassing ratio calculator that's used by all healthcare systems, including HSE, that separates people into a weight category based on their height.
But one of the arguments, I don't know whether you're aware of this or not, Jamie, but one of the arguments made on Friday was that the BMI, if you decided to go privately and pay for it yourself, in other words, not applying to VHI or not getting on that 5-year waiting list, that the BMI bar, if you go and pay for it privately, is higher than the BMI bar if you go through the system. Would you have been aware of that?
Yes, so I am. So firstly, you know, my specialty, subspecialty in plastics is breast reconstruction, breast reduction, that kind of stuff. So I come across this quite a lot. And breast reduction, it's a functional operation for people like that last lady ringing in. It's not a cosmetic operation. We understand that.
Yeah.
And there's a huge amount of people that want it. And there's a huge amount of evidence suggesting that it's the right thing to do and that it's cost-effective to the healthcare system and things like this. So it's all worthwhile doing. The problem with the BMI thing is there's also a load of evidence showing that the higher the BMI, the higher the rate of complications.
Mm-hmm.
And the rate of complications, if you get a complication with wounds and things, it increases the amount of medical time and efforts required to get things healed, such as nursing time, clinic time, dressing clinic time, junior doctor time, and possibly second surgery time. And so in the public system and the private system, it depends on how much risk that system is willing to take. The public system will generally take more risk than the private system in terms of VHI. In terms of self-pay, that's a consultant's own decision whether they think that someone is going to be really high risk for complications. And so they might set their BMI ratio at less than 33, you know, if someone's paying for it. Because then the consultant decides, well, look, that's the amount of extra time this is going to take to get healed and to have problems. Whereas the public system, you know, is a bit different. And then the VHI system is actually 27 is now the cutoff for BMI. VHI, I think the last caller said 25, but they've increased it recently in an effort to try and address this. And the point of it is,
the cutoff for if you get on the public list, which we know is very long, is that 27 as well?
No, so that varies between departments, but it's pretty much BMI of 30. And anything over that generally won't get an appointment unless it's very, very exceptional circumstances. And some people can get waived, but it's a medical problem, the weight of the breast, as opposed to a very large breast. Now, I'm not saying that's not a problem, but some people come in with breasts that are, you know, way outside the norms of large breasts. And there are some people that you can waive it. And bearing in mind, the largest weight reduction in years of doing this, the largest weight reduction that you'll take off a breast is about 2.5 kilos. But the average, and that's total, the average weight that will come off is about 1 kilo to 1.5 kilos. So a 1.5 kilo weight reduction generally doesn't cause the BMI to be, you know, above 30. And, you know, the HSE chart on BMI, 30 is the cutoff between overweight and obese. And 25 and 26, that cutoff is between average healthy weight as per HSE and the overweight category. And so the public system doing it in BMI, even if it stated 28, it's still, you know, above the cutoff limit that someone should be at in terms of being at the healthiest weight they could be.
Yeah, but we had a concrete example on Friday of a woman who decided because she wasn't eligible under the BMI bar set by the VHI / HSE, but when she decided to pay for it herself in cash, so to speak, the BMI was suddenly higher. So why is there one BMI for people who can pay and one BMI for people who can't pay?
So I would argue, so in my practice, it's not the weight. And a lot of the times you are sending people off, and people who have visited me in both public and private rooms will agree that I've sent people off to lose weight. But you're the person who, let's say it's a BMI of 30 and that patient's paid cash, or 32, that patient is paying extra for that consultant to manage the complications that are a much higher percentage chance of happening. So the consultant has made a decision based on the individual case on whether it's worthwhile to them. Would it be safer for the patient?
Yeah, but surely the BMI, and as you say, it's a pretty wide metric.
What you're talking about, the concrete case, I doubt that was a BMI of, you know, 27.5, just over what the VHI cutoff was. And so you're talking, once you get up to the BMI of over 30s, you're talking of a significant risk of wound problems and returning to dressing clinics multiple times and potential reoperations.
So then why? Where that comes in. Why do some surgeons do it then?
Because every surgeon is different. Some people are risk averse and some people are not. Some people will have the discussion with the patient in the public system and the VHI system.
But they won't have the discussion with the patient if it's VHI or in the public system, because the VHI or the public system won't pay.
So, but I don't say, not true. I mean, if a patient is over 30, the public system can't cope with the amount of complications that will create.
But how can the private system?
Because it's the patient's fees are paying for the facilities.
So it is one situation for those who can pay out of their pocket.
I would argue that the majority of plastic surgeons...
In one sense, it doesn't matter if there's only one. If there is a difference between... Not based on... If there is a difference between the BMI metric, the exact number used by VHI and HSE, and the BMI metric used by, as you say, it might be only one, I don't know, but it was a case here on Friday, and the BMI metric used by somebody who is being paid directly, well, then that is an issue. Now, maybe
Absolutely.
It's an issue at the heart of our health system.
I would argue, so the VHI cutoff is more strict, okay? We don't, as consultants, we don't have control of that. The only people that would have control, you know, are VHI and patient support, lobby support, okay? Most people, their private practice mimics the public practice. As in, in private practice, I will do a BMI of less than 30 in a breast reduction. And over that, I will ask them.
And Jamie, why do you know? Do you know why is there a 5-year waiting list?
It varies massively between hospitals. But remember, the same surgeon that's doing the breast reduction is doing breast reconstructive surgery generally as well. Yeah. We have difficulty.
Have we a shortage of your speciality in Ireland?
There's a shortage of every speciality in Ireland. You've seen, you know, every time you do this, you know, you've been ringing in about trolley weights and problems with the healthcare system. We have a healthcare system that's absolutely bulging, and we're no different as plastic surgeons. Our cancer cases, our melanomas,
One area where we don't get complaints in the last 10 years, and I've been here long enough to at least try, and is in oncology. Generally, people seem to be
That's a good thing,
Yeah, it is a brilliant thing. It is absolutely brilliant.
So the oncology is taking a little bit of priority, making sure we treat our cancers, is taking space out of things, which is so unfair to people with back pain and can't live their lives. But that is taking the space. So if I have a breast reduction on my list and three cancers and beds are tight, the three cancers will get a bed and the breast reduction will not.
Okay.
This is the issue.
Okay, Jamie, I appreciate that. I really do. And that's Mr. Jamie Martin Smith. He's a consultant plastic surgeon, and I appreciate your time, Jamie. Back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RT.ie continues 24/7 365. Producer Nadine Maloney and Kira King is next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe at RTE.ie.